appreciate all the division being here today. Let's go ahead and introduce ourselves. Start on the end down with you, Mitch.
Well, I'm going to let Joe Batty know who I am. I'm Mitch Hackett. Mr. Chairman, this is the first time I've ever seen us outnumbered. Ever. Yep. Whatever it means, I don't know.
It's good.
Okay,
good.
Cool. Okay, Joe.
Joel Batty. I'm here from agriculture. I don't know what happened.
Revadel, I'm chair at large. Daniel Davis, sportsman. Jerry Jorgensen, Bagot County.
Randy Girth, the sportsman. Yeah.
Boyd Blackwell, representing the division secretary.
Joe Arnold, the public at large.
David Gordon, representing BLM.
Melissa Wardle, non-consumers.
Appreciate everyone being here today. We got a good turnout. Appreciate it very much. First on the, we don't have any another board member, wildlife board members are here, but I'm sure Dr. Woodward would be here if he could. If anybody shows up, we'll talk about the comment cards, but I guess we won't, because I don't doubt anybody in the division needs a comment card, so we won't discuss that quite yet. But we do need approval of the agenda and the minutes of our last meeting, so let's start with the minutes of the last meeting. Has everybody had a chance to read those over? Do we have an entertaining motion to approve the minutes of last meeting? Anybody want to make that motion?
I motion that we approve the minutes from last meeting.
Okay, and a second?
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. How about the agenda today? This is the agenda. We have any, I don't know if we can change the agenda, so I guess we won't. We'll try to do that. I learned that last month that the thing we don't change the agenda. Don't change the agenda. So we'll entertain a motion to.
You can change the order.
Actually, they told us not to even do that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. But Stacy's just really hard.
I motion that we approve the agenda as it is.
Okay, a second?
I'll second.
Okay, Jerry, second. Any vote or all in favor? Looks like it's unanimous again, Gail. Yeah, thank you. All right, we'll turn the time over. As far as the Wildlife Board meeting update, let me give you an update on the Wildlife Board. The things that we approved here was pretty well the way they went there. The big discussion was the cougar update. I think we had 28, and we had 27. And they went with 29 cougars in the booklets, a little bit above bovars. That was the main, topic of that one. Pretty much everything else went in right line with this RAC committee voted. We had a training also in conjunction with the Wildlife Board meeting. There's a training out there that I was really pleased. All four of our new members were at that training. That just joined us, and that was some pretty good training out there for us. Got a good update from the division of where things are and what we should be doing as RAC members, and it was really good also. And the entire Wildlife Board was there in that training also, so got to hear a little bit from them too at that time. So we'll turn the time over to Boyd for a regional update.
Well, I had to rely mostly on Ron for this one because I've been gone for the last 6 weeks. But as you can imagine, our preseason wildlife surveys are pretty much mostly completed in the region, and everything, our wildlife in this region, the Northeast region, seems to be doing really well. We had record-breaking numbers of sage grouse. Breaking numbers on some of our sage grouse leks. An actually turned out to be the highest number in 10 to 30 years. We also have an extremely high number of rabbits this year. I don't know if you've been out, had a chance to get out and see, be a good year to go rabbit hunting. Those months that start with an or have an R in them are good months to hunt rabbits across the region. We had really good survival, winter survival on our deer and elk and pronghorn, and pretty good early counts on fawns and calves. Our early season hunts, though, have been just a little bit slow. I think the biologists would tell you that it has a lot to do with the summer rains that we had. Allowed a lot of the game to spread out so that they're not concentrated around watering holes. I've seen some big deer that have been taken so far this year, so it certainly leads me to think that we're going to have a good year this year, quality-wise. Our aquatics folks finished some really big projects, and I'm extremely proud of them and the work that they're doing here in this region. They got news this week that our road known for our Red Fleet project should be available, and it's actually arrived in the country, and we're going to send Trenton down with a pickup to...
I didn't want to go to Texas. I wanted to go to Peru.
So we have a treatment project that's set up, as you know, or we've talked a lot about it over the last little while. And it'll be the second full week of October, right? Still, okay. And just another project that's been really big, and I think has been very successful because of the efforts of our folks, is our work that focused on our Upper Sheep Creek drainage. This was part of a multi-year project to restore Colorado River cutthroat on that Upper Sheep Creek. The crews went in early and sampled up there, and they went back again and took a bunch of fish in with them this time. We moved them by horseback, by truck, by helicopter, just about anything we could do to get them up there. And one of the things is actually hiking. And those guys just hiked their butts off and really worked hard and deserve a raise. But, you know, they've really done a good job up there. Our outreach has been planning several events for this weekend. We have a waterfowl and upland game clinic this Friday. Where, in addition to the evening activities, the youth will be able to sign up for accompanied youth chucker and waterfowl hunts. It will be held on Saturday, and the young hunters will be accompanied by an experienced hunter for chuckers and waterfowl. So we're pretty excited to see how that works out. I'm looking forward to a report from Ron next week to fill me in on how that has gone. Also, and this is something that all of the RAC members can do if they want to, on Saturday we have our annual Kokanee Day up at Sheep Creek. And so the sheep are coming up. They're wonderfully, the Kokanee will be coming up the Sheep Creek, and they're wonderfully colored. And so, you know, if you want to come and see them, you can see coming up in there, and you might even see some sheep in that same general area. So that's good. If you want, the viewing site will be set up at the Sheep Creek Scenic Bay Bridge. And trail that, which is roughly 5 miles south of Manila on Highway 44. And the biologist will be there, Ron will be there, From 10 till 3?
Yep.
Okay. One more thing. The last time I was here and had something, I had the opportunity to tell you what's going on in the region. I talked about Guzzlers and our habitat crew that have really been working hard as well. It's just an awesome region to have these folks work because they do so much. And we put in 20 guzzlers this year and have a potential of 36,000 gallons of stored water. In the Blood Cliffs, Anthro Mountain,
guzzlers, 36,000.
And so it's one thing, as you all know, living out here, water is a premium. And we're excited to be able to put these in for wildlife, and many are also available for livestock that are out in the Book Cliffs. And that's quite a feat for these guys to put all these in. It takes a lot of work and effort. So with that, I'll turn the time back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Well, our first topic tonight is, and only topic tonight, as far as the action item goes, is our fishing guidebook and rule R657-13. And I guess, Mr. Cushing?
Paul Burgess.
Paul gets it tonight.
Mr. Burgess.
Mr. Chairman, members of RAC, thank you for allowing me to come to speak to you tonight. My name is Paul Bertsey. I'm the Cold Water Sport Fish Coordinator with the division. And let's see if I can get this one loaded up here. And we will be talking about the 2016 fishing recommendations tonight. You may remember, or some of you may know, that up until a few years ago, we used to come around in the spring and we would have a spring informational RAC meeting, and we would talk to you about the proposals for regulation changes for the following year. Well, the fact is that those were not very well attended, as you can see by the thousands of members of the public here tonight. And so we changed gears. We tried doing some open houses. They were marginally successful. And then we also, about 4 years ago, went to an online survey. And this year, the survey ran from May 18th to June 25th. Over 1,800 people responded to the survey, which was the highest number we've had thus far. And the survey provided us input on the regulation changes that we're proposing tonight, plus also some other management changes or questions. One of the things we always ask as part of this survey is, the last question has always been, tell us what you think about Utah fishing and do you have any suggestions for how it could change? And this year we had about 850 responses to that open-ended question. And while we didn't summarize it tonight, one of the interesting things has been that when we started this 4 years ago, we had about 50% of the people responding to the survey that said that they wanted more regulations, stricter regulations, and 50% that said that they wanted looser, more liberal regulations. This year, it was almost 70-30. 70% of the people wanted stricter regulations, 30% wanted less restrictive regulations. And what we're interpreting this from, or interpreting this as, is that those people that are asking for stricter regulations don't necessarily have an affinity for more slot limits or anything like that, but they equate those with the desire to have bigger fish. And stricter regulations don't necessarily result in bigger fish at all times. But we have been working with the managers over the last couple of years to provide increased diversity in our fisheries and also increased quality in terms of size. And one of the nice things about fisheries management is that doesn't mean that every water is going to be managed the same. We can have multiple management concepts in a single region. And we were also working on that. So those people that want to be able to go out perhaps and catch 6 or 8 rainbow trout will hopefully be able to provide that, as well as those people that are satisfied with catching 1 rainbow trout, for example, but it's 20 inches long, will work to provide those too. So, first question we asked this year was about tiger muskie. We've been working for about the last decade on producing tiger muskie in this state. We think we've finally overcome a bunch of hurdles. We're ready to move to the next level of tiger muskie management, but we wanted to know what the anglers want. We asked people that responded to the survey, do you target tiger muskie when you go fishing? And surprisingly, 41% of the people said yes. Most of that 41% said that they would not harvest a tiger muskie regardless of the length, that they only want to catch and release. And when asked what size a trophy tiger muskie is, the responses were as follows. 35% said a 40-inch tiger muskie was a trophy, 30% said a 45-inch, and 31% said a 50-inch. So faced with the dilemma, what do you do when you have a third, roughly? But if we look at it and we combine that with the people that's, you know, the response that said that they would like to catch and release only, we interpret that as saying that people think that every tiger muskie that they catch is a trophy. So while we're not proposing any regulation changes for tiger muskie this year, over the course of the next 12 months, we'll be meeting with anglers to try and figure out a way to allow the anglers to have a harvest of those fish, but at the same time, allow this idea of of a trophy tiger muskie and figuring out how to make that all work. So, another thing we did was ask about the Kokanee salmon regulations. We've created a couple new Kokanee salmon fisheries in the state this past year, and we'll probably be doing more in the future. And we wound up having 6 or 7 different Kokanee regulations throughout the state. So we want to standardize those. And so we asked, would you support a closure to possession of Kokanee salmon from September 10th through November 30th? This is statewide, all waters. And 87% of the respondents did support this recommendation. We were also asked to look at corn. Corn's been a topic of discussion as for a bait for the 30 years that I've worked for the division. It was originally outlawed because of litter issues. People would take cases of corn down to the reservoir, empty them out, and leave the case of cans there on the beach. And people were also using it for chum, which is illegal. So we asked, would you like to use corn as a bait if it were legal? Only 38% of respondents said that they would. What we didn't ask, however, was the more detailed question is, if you fish with bait, would you fish with corn? And so we will be going back and revisiting this same question next year.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Is Fish Lake one of the waters that you introduced Kokanee into?
Yes, it is. What was 2015? Electric Lake about 3 years ago.
Okay.
So I said this year, I misspoke. It's been within the last several years. And we have a couple other ideas of where we want to go in the future with Kokanee too. So another question we had was that anglers have requested that the DWR develop a sport fish slam, such as the waterfowl slam or upland slam. And this is simply that you catch a variety of different species within some time period. You submit that information to the division, and you receive some kind of reward for doing so. So we asked, would you support a slam? And if so, what species would you like to see in a slam? And there they are in order of response. Native cutthroat was one, bass was two, pike was three. We will be moving into a native cutthroat trout slam in 2016, see what kind of response we get to that, and then we'll work our way into the other ones. Okay, that's from the survey. Now moving into what our recommendations are for 2016. To standardize the reservoir kokanee closures as follows. Close to the possession of kokanee salmon from September 10th through November 30th. This would include the reservoirs. It would also include those streams that currently have a such as the Electric Lake tributaries, that say something like close to the possession of red kokanee from such a date to such a date. But there are other places like Sheep Creek, for example, at Flaming Gorge, which has a closure on it, which is separate from this. Okay?
Can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
Do they successfully reproduce naturally?
They do. Porcupine, for example, Porcupine Reservoir, Causey Reservoir, we're hoping one of the other ones that we've created with Smith and Morehouse on the north slope, we expect that to be a self-sustaining population. We also, it may not be entirely self-sustaining, but we're hopeful that Fish Lake needs very little supplemental stocking.
That's the driving force for your club.
Yes. We're trying to balance here. We have two different strains of kokanee. One spawns early in the fall, and the other one spawns later in the fall. These dates encompass most of that spawning time, regardless of whether it's the early run or the late run. But there's a couple week window there at the first of the run there that we're still trying to allow some harvest for those people that want to catch a redfish for a trophy mount. So just balancing that opportunity against the need to protect the spawners.
So could I ask a question? So you didn't say that Flaming Gorge was successfully hatching kokanee.
Flaming Gorge is our brood source, one of our main brood sources, along with Strawberry Reservoir. We actually trap the fish there for the most part, strip them, take the eggs to the hatchery, restock them into Flaming Gorge. But they also get a lot of natural reproduction, too, but we do supplemental stocking there.
What Wyoming does, too, don't they?
Yeah, we co-manage the reservoir. So in the central region, our recommendations are we have three new community fisheries there, Polk Canyon, Bartholomew, and Deer Valley Lakes. Our community fisheries have a standard two fish limit regardless of species. We would just like to apply that to those three new waters. We also have an area of Strawberry Reservoir, which has been confusing for 20 plus years, and we're finally going to try and figure this out so anglers don't get confused and law enforcement doesn't get confused. It's the area known as the ladders or steps. The current definition of the ladders or steps is dependent on reservoir elevation. We want to remove that, and we simply want to say, and the Central Utah Project Canal, commonly known as the steps or ladders, from the fenced-in upper concrete structure upstream to the tunnel at US 40 is closed to fishing. Very definitive. The northeast region here, Boyd talked about the treatment that we have planned in October for Red Fleet Reservoir. We currently have a catch and kill on the illegally introduced walleye at the reservoir. We want to just simply reinstate all the general statewide regulations for all species at Red Fleet Reservoir, because there will be no illegally introduced walleye in the reservoir come October 14th. Fish Lake, Sevier County, we mentioned that this is one of our new kokanee waters. The regulation currently there is limit 4 trout regardless of species. We want to simply change that to limit 4 trout or kokanee, regardless of species. only one of which may be over 24 inches.
Just a question in terms of consistency with Flaming Gorge being four trout, three of which may be kokanee. Why didn't the consistency carry one way or the other on that?
Because they didn't feel like, at least at this point in time, Jack, that they wanted the additional protection of the kokanee that Ryan feels is necessary at Flaming Gorge. Again, southern region, Manning Meadow Reservoir is one of our cutthroat trout brood lakes. It would be analogous to Sheep Creek Lake or Lake Canyon Lake in this region. Their current regulation is prohibits the harvest of cutthroat trout. They feel that their population in there now is large enough that they can sustain some harvest. So we just want to liberalize that to say two trout limit, regardless of species, artificial flies and lures only, closed January 1st through the second Saturday in July, and that's to protect the spawners. And that is it.
Okay, thank you. I personally haven't heard anything from the other RACs. Is there anything the other RACs in discussion that they've had any problems with?
No, the other four RACs have adopted our recommendations as proposed.
Well, we'll open it up for a question by the RAC.
I had a question. I think I might have... Are you saying that Flaming Gorge will have a different regulation on the kokanee than Crest?
They have a different possession limit when it's open to fishing for kokanee. But as far as the closure goes, we adopted the Flaming Gorge closure statewide. So theirs remains the same. Okay. The only thing that changes is that comes out of the special regulation portion and just goes into the general statewide regulation.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
A follow-up to that question and Jack's as well. Is Flaming, is Strawberry and the other kokanee-bearing lakes all going to be four kokanee and Flaming Gorge is the only one that's three?
That's the way that it is right now.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah. The difference is that at Flaming Gorge, about 60% of the fishery is targeted at kokanee. At Strawberry, for example, it's less than 10%. So there's just been a reluctance to allow an increased number in possession at Flaming Gorge because we were afraid we couldn't keep up with the demand.
Yes. Is Wyoming kind of in favor of that too?
Wyoming, we as much as possible, we have the same regulation with Wyoming on limits.
They keep pushing us on that too, probably.
Well, they want to have that three fish limit also, yeah, just as we do. And so we have a coordination meeting with them every year. If there are any differences, we sit down and try and hash them out there.
Question. If you buy a Utah license and a reciprocal stamp and also buy a Wyoming license, does that cover six fish kokanee? Is it three no matter what?
Is,
okay.
Yeah.
It's three no matter what?
No matter if you buy it, if you have a Wyoming license, okay.
Yeah, it's three in possession.
Okay.
In fact, Flaming Gorge is one of two waters in the state where it doesn't even have the multi-day possession allowance that we have in all the other waters.
I talk to a lot of people that fish kokanee at Flaming Gorge, and I don't think there's any dissatisfaction at all with that limit. I think
there's
everybody's happy.
The people that come from the Wasatch Front are more upset by the fact that they can't keep two limits before they have to drive back to the Wasatch Front. And it's understandable. It's a long way to Manila from Salt Lake.
Yeah.
It's relative.
Yeah. It's not as far. It's not as far from Manila to Salt Lake as it is going the other way, Jack.
That's right.
So, but we, by and large, people seem to be pretty supportive of our efforts.
Other questions?
Well, kind of a general biology. I seem to remember reading somewhere that salmon die off after they spawn. Is it the same with kokanee?
It is. The kokanee salmon are just a landlocked form of the sockeye. So they do. They grow for about 4 years. They spawn once, they die.
Other questions? Well, looks like we've got one visitor that just joined us. If you'd like to make a comment, there's comment cards.
Okay.
We're in the questions about the fishing guidebook rule. And is there any big questions there? All right. Comments by the audience? Comments by the rack. Well, we'll entertain a motion on this particular topic.
I made the motion that we accept the recommendation of the board for the fishing guidebook for 2016.
Okay.
I second it.
Got a motion and a second. Discussion? No discussion. All in favor? Looks like it's unanimous, Gil. All right. I appreciate that, Paul. Thank you. Up next, Sergeant Lane. Drive careful.
Thank you.
Okay, we did have one schedule change. I'm not Sergeant Lane, I'm Captain Olson. But if I say something really stupid, I'm Sergeant Lane. That work?
What happened to Captain Lane?
He got demoted, apparently, too. So. Anyway, the heavy thing is over. You guys don't have to vote on this. This is informational only, so, you know, your brain doesn't have to absorb all of this. Okay, the purpose of my recommendation or my presentation today is to look and review some of the Western states' regulations versus Utah's in regards to weapons, to go over some, or review some technological advances that have occurred in recent years, and most importantly, to present the survey results of a pretty substantial survey that we put out. As I mentioned, this is informational only. There won't be a vote on this tonight, but we do need, you'll see in a minute, we know what almost 20,000 members of the hunting public think. We now need to know what the RAC and the board think about these issues. These are social issues. They're not biological. And in context of the discussion tonight, try to distinguish between social issues and ethical issues, because there's a difference. Ethical issues are almost in the eye of the beholder. If you ask the Humane Society of the United States, all hunting is unethical. If you ask a dyed-in-the-wool flintlock muzzleloader, inline muzzleloaders, unethical. A longbow hunter is going to say a compound bow is unethical. So don't get those two terms aren't interchangeable. Okay, this issue has not been looked at by the division for at least 10 to 15 years. And one thing we found real quick is it's very difficult to compare different states' regulations. A large part of that is due to different hunt structures. Some states have two muzzleloader seasons. One where you have to use an open weather ignition muzzleloader, and another season that you can use any kind of muzzleloader. So we're almost not comparing apples to apples on all of these things we found out. But I'll show you, we did the best we could do. Okay, as I mentioned, we sent out a survey. It was an online by email invitation only survey to 77,000 deer and elk hunters from last year that were at least 18 years or older. The survey was open between July 27th and August 16th. To each question, you had three options, a yes, a no, or a no opinion. You'll see in a minute, people have an opinion on this.
Mr. Chairman, can I throw a quick question before we get going in? On these, what percentage of these would you say were rifle hunters?
I'll get into that in just a second.
Is that?
We had over 19,000 responses. This is the highest number of responses the division has ever received on any survey that they've ever put out in its history. So people care about this. People are interested in these topics. Okay, one of the questions we asked was, what type of weapon do you hunt big game with most often? These are the results. Now, when we went into this survey, we thought that we would have to present each question basically three times, meaning that we thought archery hunters are going to think one way, muzzleloader hunters will answer the questions differently, and rifle hunters a third way. As it turned out, there was less than 2% difference in any of the answers. So I'm gonna present the results tonight combined because it doesn't change anything if we look at them individually. Okay, the first issue that we looked at was the use of a draw lock. Does everybody in here know what a draw lock is? Okay, there's a picture of one. It effectively turns your vertical bow into a crossbow. You pull the it only works on a comp. Anybody ever seen one on a longbow? I don't think they would work on a longbow. But they're designed to go on a compound bow. You pull it back, you lock that in, and then that bar will hold it at full draw, and you release it with a trigger mechanism.
Does it release from the bar, or do you have to pull it off the bar?
Most of the ones I saw, you just release. There's a trigger, and the bar just falls off. Okay. During an archery hunt, three states allow these. 10 do not. 3 are silent on it. And this is where the difficulty comes in. In some states, if they're silent on the regulation, that means you can use it. Some states, it means you cannot use it.
Captain, which states did you say Western?
Yeah, I'll get in. I'll have a map here in a little bit that shows what states. Utah is a no on a general archery hunt unless you have a COR. But you can use a vertical bow with a draw lock during the illegal weapon season.
What's the COR?
Certificate of registration means if you're handicapped or you've had shoulder surgery, for some reason you're too old, you can't pull back a bow. If you get a doctor's signature, then you can get a permit to possess and use one of these during a general archery season.
Are those things kind of dangerous?
Well, that's in the eye of the beholder, I guess.
I mean, is that why they're outlawed in other states? Is because of
no, they're probably, we don't know for sure. The most common criticism about this is that it gives somebody an advantage. You'll see when I get into the crossbow discussion. One of the biggest things, if you're archery hunting and you're waiting for an animal to come to you, what spooks most animals?
Movement.
It's the movement. And so if you have to draw a bow, that's a disadvantage versus you can just sit there and hold still without the weight on it. So you're not using your muscles at all. You can just sit there and release it.
And that's why it's a no for Utah.
Yeah, Utah, that's why it's a no for Utah. We asked our hunting public what they thought of this issue. 69% of our hunting public, almost 70%, do not want these allowed during a general archery season. So they're not allowed now. They want to continue to have them illegal to use. Next issue we looked at, magnified scopes on a bow. 7 states don't allow them. 8 are silent on it. Utah's a no. On an archery hunt, again, you could put a scope on a bow and use it on any legal weapon hunt. So on the rifle hunt, if you chose to, you could use a bow with a scope on it. We asked our hunters what they thought. 70% do not want magnified scopes on bows. Okay, we didn't look at other states concerning range finders, but this is a question we commonly get. You know, why can't I put a range finder on my bow? So we ask our hunters, you want range finders on a bow? 60% of them said yes. That's a real common one when you're out in the field. Public, our officers struggle at times to answer this question. Why is it okay if I can have a handheld rangefinder and go like this, but I can't have one on my bow to go like this?
Now that's 60% of the bow hunters?
No, that's 60% of everybody. If we looked at this individually, it actually goes up higher. The bow hunters do not want this.
Do they make a rangefinder that mounts on a bow?
Yeah.
They do. It's activated by your grip handle on your bow. You can push a button on your bow and it'll shoot the laser out and give you a reading.
Okay, crossbows. This issue of crossbows is what started this whole discussion, really. Last year, we had a legislator that ran a bill to allow crossbows on an archery hunt. He eventually withdrew that bill, but the division made a commitment to him that we would take this through the public process and see what the public wants. We told him we'd done this before, but we'll do it again. Okay, on this map, the states in green allow crossbows during an archery season. The states in blue do not. As you can see, Utah's a no, except with the COR again.
Any reason you think Wyoming's a yes, surrounded by all the no's?
Yeah, if you look, we don't know for sure why this is. But if you look at the states that do allow crossbows, they're, other than Wyoming, it's kind of split in half. They're predominantly white-tailed deer states. Almost all states back east allow crossbows. But they hunt different than you hunt out west here. It's really vegetated. If you hunt back east, you're pretty much in a tree stand or a ground blind. Crossbows are really heavy. If any of you picked up a crossbow, they're very heavy. They're hard to lug around. I mean, you're not going to spot and stalk very effective with a crossbow.
I think they've allowed them for 25 plus years. Back when I was there, I know a guy that used to hunt with it years.
Yeah, they back east, they're a common weapon. But most of them are sitting in a blind. A lot of them have a stand or their tree or their blinds will have a little bar or something to hold them in like a lagoon ride, and they'll rest it on that.
Well, a lot of the reasons back east too as well is a lot of them states won't allow some gun hunts to take place. So for them to hunt, it has to be archery only in certain areas. And so when you get the youth involved to bring a weapon to the table and be ethical about harvesting an animal and being effective, a crossbow is about the only option because they can still carry the knockdown, as referred to, power. So a youth can harvest one of those animals.
Yeah, now there are probably some misconceptions about crossbows out there. A lot of people think you can shoot farther with a crossbow. The data says that's not necessarily true. A crossbow comes out of the chute faster, the bolt comes out faster, although some of these really new bows are probably approaching the same speed. But it loses its energy because the bolt or the arrow is short, it's a lot shorter. And so at around 60 yards, a crossbow starts to lose its energy, where some of the more advanced compound bows, they have a lot more energy. You can kill animals farther than 60 yards. So they're not really an advantage as far as how far you can shoot.
Do they use scopes on those crossbows, or
we'll,
are they?
We'll get to that in just a second. Okay, we ask our hunters, should crossbows be allowed during a general archery deer hunt? 60% said no. We ask them, what about an elk hunt? Again, 60% no. And notice on all of these, the no opinions are really low. I mean, most surveys, you get, you know, say a rifle hunter that always hunts rifles, never hunts muzzleloader, never hunts bow, you would expect they would say, I don't have an opinion. But they didn't.
Because archery season happens before their rifle season.
Maybe. Maybe. But regardless, they have an opinion. We also ask them about a limited entry hunt for deer, elk, or pronghorn. Percentage of no's dropped down just a little bit, but it's still the vast majority. We ask one other question. If we did allow crossbows during an archery hunt, should you be able to put a magnifying scope on them? An even higher percentage, almost 70%, said no. This creates a little bit of a problem because most of the crossbow manufacturers out there put a scope on the crossbow and it's almost integrated into the crossbow where it's not just like you undo a couple of screws and take it off. They can be removed, but it's kind of difficult. Okay, muzzleloaders. This is the next hottest issue that we found. Again, the states in green allow a magnified scope during a muzzleloader hunt. States in blue do not. Utah's a no, except with a COR. But again, you can put a multi-powered scope on your muzzleloader and use it during the rifle hunt or the any legal weapon hunt.
Are the muzzleloader hunts all the same in terms of what you were saying, open to the weather, flintlock type versus?
No, that's where it gets hard to decipher some of these things. The states that have had a split were, you know, a truly primitive one, they still answered no on this because you can't use a scope on all the muzzleloader hunts that they have. We ask our hunters, just reversed from the bows, our hunters do want to use magnified scopes on a muzzleloader during a muzzleloader season.
Now you say you polled the muzzleloader hunters as well. What was their reaction?
You know what? I'm not sure on that one. It was really close again. It wasn't that much. The archers had the biggest swing, but there was a little swing in this too. I don't know. We don't know why. If you read the comments, we had 7,000 comments. That was too many to try to go through and read. And we thought we could group them into themes, but they were just all over the board. there were two things. If there was a two common themes, you seen the words fair chase a lot in the comments, and you seen there would be less wounding loss if I could use a scope. So I don't know if our hunting public is getting a little older. I mean, I now have to use these to read, so does Jack. And they want to see a little better. I don't know. But regardless, they support magnified scopes on muzzleloaders, but they don't on bows.
Is there a question of the magnification?
I mean, we didn't put any type of
that. That's a lot of the feedback I've got.
Yeah, me too.
You know, with the single power, it makes everything look smaller.
Oh, it does.
So a lot of the people that I've talked to that actually participated in the survey wish it would have been a magnification specific.
Like went just four power less or two power
straight.
Or something.
Because two power gives you the same depth and view as your naked eye, if you will.
Right. I've had a couple of guys, a couple of RAC members in other regions come up and say they've talked to ophthalmologists and have been told that you have to have at least a two power magnification to equal what your eye sees. Now, I don't know if that's...
So they're increasing fair chase by keeping it at one power.
Yeah, I don't know. I've looked through one power ones. I shoot open sights on my muzzleloader.
Yeah.
Because a one power scope makes the target look farther away to me than open sights. I think the only reason some hunters put a one power scope on their muzzleloader is because at least you have a red dot or a set of crosshairs that may help a little bit.
Part of the difference too might be that at about 45, 50, the number of archery drops off pretty heavily, those that are archery, but it picks up in muzzleloaders and rifles, so you're going to have an age difference where you got the younger eyes versus, you know, some younger, guys
yeah,
younger eyes.
Yeah, trust me, it. Not sure how, you're probably not there yet, but you will.
I'm getting there.
Anyway, for whatever reason, our hunters do want it legal to put a magnified scope on a muzzleloader.
And you think as well that maybe some of that is the primitive versus the new inline stuff? There's a
not
variation.
Sure. We can't.
Even the muzzleloader themselves.
Yeah, we can't really determine that. I mean, I try to stay away from the word primitive anymore because a compound, modern compound bow, I'm not sure that's primitive. Now, it is compared to some other things we'll get into in just a minute, but...
Traditionalists? What do you call them?
But the inline muzzleloaders, I mean, when you're out there, how many flintlocks do you check now, Jack, on the muzzleloader hunt? You
don't know that I've checked one.
You'll see maybe one or two a season, a year maybe. Everybody has that line.
Yeah.
It depends on if Don Archer comes out with his. I don't know of anyone else that even shoots one.
So, like I said at the beginning, this is informational only. We'll be coming back in a month in November with some kind of recommendation. We don't know what that's going to be yet. That's why we need feedback. We've got feedback from the public. Now we kind of need feedback on what the RAC and the board would support.
So is there any type of a question asking whether technology would supersede our wildlife and chance of over-harvesting because they
can't get
away?
There's a lot of questions we would have liked to ask. But you have to know a little bit about surveys, and I don't know that much about them myself, but we've got a really smart statistician, actually called a biometrician, that looks at this stuff. And if you ask, in fact, she was worried that we asked one too many questions on this survey. You hit a point, if you ask too many questions, people look at it, takes too long, won't partake in the survey.
Or their answers drop off because they're in a hurry to
get
through this thing, get out of there.
So we must have got it right this time or been pretty close because we had so many respondents.
Is there any discussion of the two separate seasons if magnifying scopes were allowed? Is there
We haven't yet.
Called the rifle.
Yeah, I've had that comment before. The problem is we almost need another month in the calendar. Our hunt, if the board or the racks wanted to squeeze in another type of hunt somewhere, somebody else is going to lose out. There's not much time. I mean, we've got hunts running from, you know, 1st of August till the end of January. So is it possible? Yeah, you could, but there's a give and take there. Who's going to get shorted?
Can you use a muzzle loader during the rifle hunt?
Yes. You can use any weapon that's legal during what's commonly referred to as the rifle hunt. It's really called the any legal weapon hunt. That's why it's called like that. I still prefer to call it the rifle hunt because everybody knows what the rifle hunt is. Okay, moving on to rifles. 7 states have no minimum caliber. This is to hunt big game, just to hunt big game. 4 states require 22 cal or larger, 5 states 24 or larger. Utah, where we made it a little simpler, is just center fire with an expanding bullet. We did not ask a question on our survey about minimum caliber because we seldom, if ever, get the question, what's the littlest gun I can shoot a deer with? We just don't get that. But we get a lot of questions on what's the biggest gun I can shoot a deer with? Okay, only 2 states regulate or have a maximum caliber regulation. North Dakota has a maximum caliber of .49, so they outlaw the common 50 cal. Idaho attempts to do this with the weight of the gun. You cannot use a gun that weighs more than 16 pounds. Initially, when I looked at this, I didn't like it. I'm still not sure I like that, but because I didn't really want Jack to have to say, "Can I see your license? And I need to weigh your gun." And then have a scale and weigh the gun. Okay, but in talking to Idaho, what they were really trying to do here, you know, why is a large caliber even an issue? With most hunters, it's not the size of the shell as much as how far it shoots. They don't agree with some of this real long distance shooting in a hunting environment. There's lots of smaller calibers that shoot just as far as a 50 cal. So I think that's what Idaho is trying to regulate, was the long distance shooting, not necessarily the big caliber, which most people equate into long distance. We ask our hunters what they thought. 71% do not like 50 cal or larger. Now, again, I don't think that's necessarily the size of the bullet that matters to them. I think it's the long-distance shooting is the root of the problem. But, they just don't like, you know, a round that you hold one round in your hand.
So currently it's legal.
Currently it's legal in Utah. It's legal in every state except those 2.
You think there will be an attempt to legislate against it?
I don't think there will be at the legislative level. I think it'll come from this level.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you want? That's why we're here, asking you what you want. We ask the public. They don't want them. They want them outlawed.
To me, I kind of favor more of Idaho's. You know, I was playing on YouTube the other day, and you know, was it 9 or 12-year-old taking a 1,300-yard shot at an elk? And I'm just going, wait a minute, that seems a little far to be an ethical shot, in my opinion. So
we had one of them YouTube. I mean, YouTube and Facebook. We make a lot of cases off of YouTube and Facebook. But
Facebook's
that's the one public guy here. That's the tip of the day. If you do something really stupid and illegal, don't put it on Facebook or YouTube. But we had somebody put on YouTube. Somebody put on YouTube last year this guy that made like a 1,300-yard shot on a cow elk, and we had like a dozen calls to our help stop poaching line immediately after it hit.
Wasn't there an issue, a very popular big game hunter publication go on a CWMU hunt with a magnified range finding scope on a muzzleloader?
We've had a few of those over the years. I can't remember one that a long distance thing, but yeah, we get a lot of calls to our UTIP line, Utah Turn In a Poacher line, on these hunting shows. The most common one is the guy wasn't wearing orange. Okay, not the crime of the century, but it is still a violation. But when you go investigate those, almost 95 or higher percent of the time, there's raw footage of the actual shot where the guy was wearing orange, but it's not cool to wear orange in a TV show, so then they take the orange off and make it look like he wasn't wearing orange when he shot it.
That'd be my story.
I have one comment. Most of the modern long-range rifles are nowhere near the 49.
I know a lot of them are.
They're 30, 378s, and
there's
the hybrid.
330-something, LaCour.
Yeah, so unless you're proposing to go, you won't really have any impact.
No, we're not proposing anything.
You don't think that's... I kind of heard you say maybe we...
No, we're not proposing anything yet. We asked this question on the survey because this is a common question we get in the field or at our offices. Are 50 calibers legal to use?
Most of the really, if you want to view it as a problem of long range shooting, are the same caliber. They're the same. They're 30 caliber.
A lot of them are, I think.
So I'm
not sure on those.
I am a long range guy. So
are you?
Yeah, I love it. It's exactly the opposite challenge of an archer.
Okay.
So there's a lot of factors.
And what's a common long range gun?
I shoot a 300 Rum, so it's a Remington Ultra Mag. Okay, just like a 300 Winchester mag. So.
And I would say that I haven't checked anybody with a 50 caliber.
I've checked several with 50 caliber.
There's all different ranges. I have 6.5, 284, which is a good antelope gun. You got a 7 Rum, 300 Rum, 338 LaPoker. So those are probably the fairly standard long range weapons.
So you're exactly right, though. If we were to propose a regulation to cut down on long-range shooting, doing it by caliber won't affect it that much.
It'd have to be almost like a yardage.
Yeah, but that is very difficult to enforce.
I know it is. That's why it's like it's impossible. It's more
yardage.
So with the long-range shooting, are you finding what's the violation?
There is no violation. We have no regulation. If you can shoot one of the other racks, a guy, I can't remember the website or the exact, something about pile them up at a quarter mile. We'll get into this next weapon in just a minute with that stuff. Oh, one other question we asked in relation to rifles are these pretty new range finding scopes. The only one that I'm aware of is the Burris Eliminator, but it's got a built-in rangefinder in the scope. Just like a pair of binoculars with a rangefinder in it. Okay, currently those are legal in Utah, and the hunting public wants them to remain legal, although I've only seen one or two ever.
They're getting
more popular.
Yeah, there's more companies
that make them.
So what's the current distinction between projecting a laser that has to be visible?
Yeah, it has to be invisible to be legal. If it projects a visible laser, they're illegal the way Utah's laws are right now. But I don't know if there's any range finders that put out a visible laser or not.
No, it just projects a laser to
Yeah, as long as you can't see the laser, it's okay. Which I'm glad it doesn't project, doesn't have a visible laser, because it makes you a little nervous when all of a sudden you see a little red dot floating around you when some guy is looking.
You really don't want to know how often people look at you through their screen.
I know. Okay, now the really cool stuff. Smart guns. Does everybody here know what a smart gun is? It's a gun that has a computer-aided aiming device on it. If you want to see something impressive, go to Google trackingpoint.com, and you'll see one of these weapons. I don't even like to call it a firearm. It's a weapon. But the way these things work in lay terms, the little red dot there or crosshairs, at some point you have to put that on the target. As soon as it's on the target, you push a button. It's called tagging. You then hold the trigger and you just aim down, and when you get exactly the right spot, it will go off on its own. You will always hit. They've even got goggles now that are tied into that, where you don't even have to. I watched a demo on the internet where a guy's got, he tagged his target, then he put goggles on and looked over here, and he could see the dot in his goggles and hit his target that way. These are really cool weapons. Probably very appropriate for military. Maybe even some law enforcement. I don't know about hunting. We asked our hunters what they thought. 84% want these outlawed. They're not outlawed now. You can't get 84% of the people to agree that the sky is blue. You never see a survey result that high.
How many have been used in Utah that we even know of?
I don't know. There's chatter out there on some of the, Monster Muley and stuff like that, the websites that.
There might be one or two anyway.
Yeah, they're very expensive. This is not something that average Joe Blow would go buy anyway, but there's a lot of people out there that if $20,000, $30,000 is nothing for them. If you paid $800,000 for a deer tag, I bet the guy wouldn't bat an eye at spending another $20 for a gun that would guarantee he would not miss. Now, we haven't seen them in Utah yet, but eventually we will. Okay, so as a summary, according to our survey, our Utah hunters do not support crossbows on the archery hunt. They want rangefinders on bows. They want magnified scopes on muzzleloaders. And they want large calibers and smart guns outlawed. Now, this is the tip of the iceberg for this technology stuff. We started to, but it was too big, to look at round ball versus sabot, draw weights on bows, arrow length, broadhead size, putting poison tips, or what they call them pods, poison pods on the tip of a broadhead, that quite common back east apparently. There's a lot of different stuff we didn't look at. We got to bite this off in chunks, or it becomes too complicated to manage. Okay, thank you.
You left two of them off on that. Was there a reason? The draw lock and...
Oh, you talked about the draw.
No, I just hit the highlights.
They weren't on the...
All of them.
If we had to do what the public wants according to the survey, we don't have to do anything with crossbows because they're already outlawed on archery. We would have to change the regulation to allow a rangefinder on a bow, a magnified scope on a muzzleloader, and then regulations that would outlaw smart guns or a large caliber or some variation of that.
And all of those would be brought to the...
Yeah, anything that we would change would be brought back around again as an action item where you would vote on them.
The only one that I guess none of those give me heartburn at all, personally. But the as far as the large caliber goes, I own a 338 Ultra Mag, got it from a bear hunt, and it's ultralight, so it's it's definitely a whole lot less than 60 pounds. So uh-huh. I think you'd have to go to a little caliber instead of a
weight.
Personally, I think that'd be what you do it.
Yeah, we don't know. Somebody way above my pay grade will make this call.
Yeah.
will you guys consider what the muzzleloader hunters want, what the bow hunter, or I say want, but give to their strategy, you know, their response to those questions? Because yeah, it's a general public thing, but
well, these were not general public. They at least were hunters.
Sure, that's.
But if you looked at it by weapon type, archery hunters still want rangefinders on a bow. They don't want crossbows. And nothing changes in all of this if you look at it by weapon type.
I thought you said the bow hunters didn't want rangefinders.
Excuse me?
I thought you said they didn't want the rangefinders.
No, they do.
Oh, wow.
They don't want scopes. They don't want a scope on a bow, but they do want a rangefinder. So I'm not sure.
The scopes on muzzleloaders, more accurately, magnification.
Yeah.
I've got some question comments. I'm going to approach them not from the sportsman's side, but probably from the humane side of things. I raise livestock. We've got land where a lot of hunting is done, and I see what goes on and what happens. I guess the big question I got is, if you got a new technology, would it make the weapon more lethal? And if it did make it more lethal, my next question is, would it be more humane?
I don't.
My next question is, if it is more lethal, more humane, would there be less collateral damage after a hunt?
Well, that's one.
A lot of collateral damage after a bow.
I can't answer that for sure. There's two trains of thought there. Now, logic somewhat tells you if you can see something better, you can make a cleaner shot, you're going to have less wounding loss. That makes sense. That probably would hold out. But if you put a 9-power scope on a muzzleloader, will you now have muzzleloader hunters try to shoot 500 yards and start wounding more animals that they would not have shot at prior because they couldn't even see it?
Or they're still shooting at them even without a scope.
And they may be. I mean, if we don't know.
Okay, then the next question. You're supporting two of the technologies, but yet you're dropping two of the other technologies. You can choose that same argument on the ones that you're keeping. You're going to make it more, they're going to try to reach out to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, remember, we're not proposing anything. We're asking the people what they think.
You know, my opinion is if you're going to take the bottom two, you need to take the auto, throw in the draw lock and the magnifying scopes on the bows, too. And that's my opinion.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood your question.
Well, you're talking like they support the rangefinders on the bows, and they support the magnifying scopes on the muzzleloaders. Well, it looks a little bit hypocritical to me if they're opposed to the draw locks and opposed to the magnifying scopes on the bows. That's my opinion. They do want the technology on this, but the technology not on that.
Right. I'm not sure why that is. We don't know. Sometimes you can't guess what the public's thinking.
And I'll reiterate where I come from. If it makes it more lethal, then to me it's more humane and it's less clever damage. You know, I'm not in support of 50 calibers or the others, but the other two, the draw locks and those ones there. Where you reached out on these other two, my opinion is we should do all four of them. And that's the reason.
Mm-hmm.
Were draw locks allowed with the COR?
Yes.
They are?
Yes.
So for if you're registered, all you have
those,
to come.
A scope on one would be allowed if your eyesight is bad enough.
Okay.
Draw locks good on any weapon?
You can use a draw lock on any weapon hunt. You can on any legal weapon hunt, you can use a crossbow with a scope, a vertical bow with a draw lock, a vertical bow with a scope, and a rangefinder, or a rifle.
How do you make a decision as far as, I mean, when you make your decision process, you don't go strictly just off your subject.
No, it'll be a collaborative effort. We'll reach out to some of the special interest groups, you know, Utah Bowman Association, muzzleloader groups, get their opinion. But we can't just discount the general hunting public, too.
Well, maybe the Humane Society.
You know, do the people, you know, I guess I'd ask a question. Do the people that come here, do you think they're representative of the general hunting public that come to the rack and board meetings?
Depends on the special interest.
Depends on the issues. Well, that's our job, too, though.
It is.
We're here. We've been put in by people who want us to represent.
Correct. And that's why we haven't. That's why we haven't proposed.
I have a question, and some may not find it relevant, but of your survey, is there a demographics of the state where the questionnaires came from?
No.
Or where those who responded, they came from?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know if they could do that by a zip code or something or not.
You could do what did when they came in. Did you know who it was when they came in, or were they anonymous?
They were, well, there was an ID number there that could be tracked back, I guess. But no, a lot of people put their names. I mean, when you get in the comment section, I mean, of course, we had comments about fishing in the comments as well. If you provide a comment, they're going to put anything they want to talk about, whether it's related to the subject or not.
Was there any difference in speciation as far as muzzleloader being used for the bull elk during the rut, but the muzzleloader with magnification used during, as far as speciation goes? It was just pretty general as far as general hunts, whether or not they were acceptable practices.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions?
Make a statement. I do not like the smart guns. It's more that you're not the one. I mean, you have the hand on the trigger, but you're not actually pulling the trigger. It seems like
you're kind of pulling the trigger. You're not aiming yourself.
Yeah.
So
at least you're holding on to the gun.
Yes.
It's not doing it by itself.
If you weren't, see, initially we've got a regulation that outlaws remote computer hunting, where the gun is somewhere different than the hunter, and you're operating the gun with a computer. That's illegal. We initially thought that would apply to smart guns, but when you get in and read it, and our attorney said no, because you're holding the gun. If we want these outlawed, we'd have to write a new regulation.
Now, what if I want to hear a biological standpoint from this? Do you have any comments to that?
Well, go ahead. Anybody, you can ask me a question.
For wildlife population basis, you know, with all, you know, I referred to it earlier as technology, but
if the success rate becomes detrimental to the population, then we have a problem. And they would reduce the number of permits. They would reduce opportunity to make up for that, what would be lost to the in the population.
Right. There could be a trade-off there, but we don't know.
Surveys we've seen all over the years where they want bigger bucks and more deer, but this kind of goes the other direction.
That's because they're a social issue, and it really does not affect the population. I can ask a question, or or tag numbers, social or biological?
Yes.
Social.
Yes.
They're pretty much social.
Yes.
They're not biological. We tie them to biology by saying the population can support X number of harvest without the population going up or down. But tag numbers, hunt dates, most all of those regulations are social regulations. They deal with people. We're managing people.
So it's turning into a thing of killing, not so much hunting.
Well, it depends with some of this stuff. That's what you guys have to decide. We'll have to make a decision, the division will at some point. What's going to be our proposal? What are we going to propose? And then it will be up to five racks and a wildlife board to either support that or go a different direction.
Any other comments or questions about that, members?
I have one more question. Jeff Smith, Sportsman here on the board. Did you get an opportunity to take the survey, and did you take the survey?
I got the opportunity and took it.
I did not get the opportunity. And how do your feelings reflect what came out in the survey?
Probably about 80%. I supported the way it came out, and the other ones I didn't. I wasn't wanted for rangefinders on bows.
Same thing. And I did reach out to other sportsmen and to talk about it working, especially this time of the year. The magnified scopes on muzzleloaders, they all feel that tube power is sufficient. They feel that it goes back to that comment I made earlier, just because I've heard it, is you put a scope on a muzzleloader that hunts before a rifle hunt. Well, now you got a rifle hunt before a rifle hunt. So it's contradicting in both facets, but when it came out without having the magnification designation, everybody that I've talked to and I've seen on social media talk about is a two-power magnification limit. The rangefinders on bows goes back to the same thing as magnification on muzzleloaders. All bow hunters that I've talked to and interact with don't feel rangefinders should be on bow.
There is one point that we've kind of hit it, let's get over it. If people want to use that stuff, they can use it during the all the
exactly. That's the thing, is there's no limits other than the legal ones.
But also,
it could be used then.
Also, yeah. I've heard the reverse comment there. Just if the regulation was you could use any power scope on a muzzleloader, that doesn't mean you have to.
Sure.
If you want to still, you know, we still have a few hunters out there with longbows and recurves.
And iron sights on the muzzleloaders.
So I see you've got the most votes to go from there. I bet that's the right one.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, can I make a comment or a couple of comments?
Please do. Step up to Mike, state your name, and if you represent anybody other than yourself, tell us that.
My name is Andy Adamson. First of all, I guess I'll state off. I've already got a COR to use a crossbow. I've had multiple surgeries on my shoulders and kind of a hard life, I guess. But anyway, I wanted to talk just a little bit about crossbows and maybe share a couple things with you on those. First of all, I've got a couple points on it. First of all, on crossbows right now are no more effective than archery, any other archery equipment. They're just not. I mean, I've been kind of a crossbow crusader. I think you've talked with Kelly Hicks. He's my buddy. We trade off a lot of stuff. But on crossbows, back east, anywhere, that they haven't shown anywhere that they're any more effective than traditional archery. Not at all. Not there's zero percentage difference. When I talked to Wyoming stopped tracking about 10 years ago now because there was no difference. There was statistically, the harvest rates were the same. So there's always a lot of talk on crossbows are much more effective. They're not. Now, there's not any proof that you can show that it is. I mean, you pull back on one, but I've got a crossbow that's about that wide that I've got a lift up and move around.
It really kind of is the same thing.
The other thing I want to talk about is what I do for a living is human resources. And so I have to look at things in a certain way. Right now, archery is pretty much male-dominated from 18 to 40. I did a grammar request here about a year or so ago because I wanted to look at the numbers and see. So I contacted the DWR, or the state, got a grammar request for the information because I wanted to see the hunting numbers for all youth. I'm a father. I've got two daughters and two sons. And my daughters are getting bigger. But, you know, I've loved archery. I've shot archery, you know, my whole life. I've loved it. And when I couldn't do it, that sucked. And then I never wanted to do a crossbow because I had opinions about crossbows. And then when I finally couldn't do bows, after about a year, I picked up a crossbow, and it was different. They are really hard to carry around. They're heavy. They're not the best for spot and stock. But when you look at the age group, right now, for females in archery, is about 13% on the under 18. 13% of them, the other, 87% are males. When you look, it really doesn't change a whole lot as you get older. When you look at rifle hunting, it's a higher percentage of females that participate. Muzzleloaders, also a higher percentage of females that participate. When you hit about 40, mid-40s, the archery numbers start to really tank down. But the numbers for muzzleloader, for some quit hunting, but a lot of them will transfer over to muzzleloaders or into rifle hunting. I've noticed that with my dad. He's finally got a COR. He's almost 80, so he couldn't really pull back anything anyway. And he's done a turkey hunt with me, but he hasn't really done anything else. When I look at my daughters, I've got some very large neighbor boys. You know, they're 16-year-old boys, no sweat, 14-year-old boys. They're pulling back a big bow. They're shooting. I mean, girls, they're just not, you know, there's such a lower percentage on all the hunting of the girls that are entering hunting. On my side, if I did that in hiring practices, I'd get sued for a term called desperate impact. That means that the way I hired people disproportionately affected different groups. Right now in archery, there's a disproportionate effect on females. It's not a dig on females, but you can clearly see, you know, across all the states, that does have a different impact. I've got several friends. I've got friends with daughters. They're all saying, yeah, if we could do a crossbow, absolutely, I'd take my daughter to hunt. Also, you know, it gets into with kids right now. My kids play sports. They do 4,000 things. It's hard. We'll go out and shoot. You know, I've got my daughter a bow, and we'll go shoot a bit. My other daughter's starting to use her bow a little bit, but they, you know, they, sometimes it's hard to get out with them as much as I like, and I can help them. You know, I'd rather have her have a nice crossbow when we're going to go shoot that elk out of the ground blind. It doesn't matter. The elk can't see us. They can't see any movement or anything else, but I feel better knowing that she's got something other than the 40-pound bow. She's shooting, you know, more, I think, a more ethical shot on the animal. But I just want to throw that out there that there's a lot of things that people think about crossbows that just aren't true. You know, they're not more effective. They're not, you know... I would question, you know, shooting bows are not really that much easier. I mean, you know, crossbow, I can tune up the crossbow and have the kids shoot it, and they'll shoot well. But I also know for my daughter that after I helped her tune up her bow, or I had my friend help me tune up her bow, she can shoot that really well, too. I mean, at 20, 30 yards, it's not a big deal. But I just wanted to throw that out there that, you know, I do think that if we did include crossbows, some of my buddies from the Utah Bowmen's Association and that aren't happy when we talk about this because they feel... that it's upsetting to them because they're saying, hey, this sucks. Archery tags are the easiest ones to get. If we let crossbows in, it's going to bring more competition into the tags and make it harder for us to draw our tags. But then the next time I talk to them, they're saying, well, but we want more tags for archery. And I said, well, where's your line? If you want more tags for archery, you've got to be a little more inclusive, you know, to get more people want to get those. Anyway, I just wanted to say that. I'm not representing anybody but myself. This doesn't affect me because I've already got a crossbow. When I look at my daughters or some of my friends or some of the people that might be interested in archery, that'd be a good thing. And nationwide right now, archery is the very fastest group of hunters growing in hunting. I mean, that's what people are wanting to do. And within hunting in all the other states, crossbows was by far the fastest group growing within the archery community. So they're, you know, it's gaining popularity. I talked to a DWR official from Missouri here the other day. And just asking him, and they're kind of going through this too, and he was laughing because he said, you know, the same thing we're going through right now with crossbows is the same thing that we went through when we brought compound bows in, you know, in the 70s. He said that everybody, these are the exact same arguments, the exact same things that brought it up. That didn't really end hunting, you know, it didn't end archery, but it went well. And I think that if crossbows are allowed, it's not going to end hunting, but it's going to bring more opportunity to more people to enjoy the sport and be out at that time of year. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we don't. This is anything we have to have an action item on. So,
no.
Captain Rick, appreciate you being here and giving us this. And good luck on where you're going to take it.
Yeah, it's some of the other regions. Not to put you on the spot, but they went down and made every member give a synopsis of what they support or don't support. That's up to you.
It's up to us. You got anybody want to do that?
Not me. You're the chairman. Take a vote. Take a vote.
Well, not really a vote.
It's just what each person thought.
Yeah.
Missy, we'll start with you. Anything? Well, anything give you heartburns?
Views on the smart guns. I think from a humane society point, we probably wouldn't like anything that would give an advantage. But there's also the other side, flip side of that, being that it's more likely to get a humane kill. So I'm not sure. Thoughts on that? Really decide what way or the other. I was only really had much shotguns, so I don't really know much about calibers. And I fit from 22. That's about all I know. So.
Okay.
But. All right. Well, from referee setting BLM, it doesn't really matter from the BLM perspective. But me myself, I personally like the idea of the use of a crossbow in the archery. Rangefinder on a bow, I'm neither here or there on. Same with the magnifying of on a bow. I'm just kind of shocked that they actually have some technology out there like that now. Scopes, I'm in favor of that on muzzleloaders. And for me, it's not really the caliber what bothers me more. It's the yardage is what they're shooting. I'm more concerned of I can make that shot, and nope, you didn't hit the animal correctly, and it goes wanders off wounded and dies later. And I don't like the idea of using smart guns. You know, that's me, you know, my personal opinions. But representing the BLM, none of these really affect the way we would manage the land.
Thank you.
Myself, I agree with most of this. And brings up some good points on crossbows that I probably hadn't heard. Talked to a friend the other day who was an avid bow hunter, and he said that his father would like to go bow hunting, but shoulder surgeries and so forth. So he brought up the point of crossbows. So I'm still probably wavering on crossbows, mostly against them, but still, you know, not sure that I have an opinion. And not being an archer myself, mostly devoted to rifles. Rangefinders on bows, again, the gentleman, Mr. Hacking at the end of the table, brings up some good points about ethical, you know, hunting and lethal hunting. And so I think rangefinders on bows are, why not? I mean, you're using it here, you're using it here. That doesn't seem to be a lot of difference between pressing the button, whether it's on the bow or if it's in your hand, or I'm sure they're going to have a pair of glasses that you can wear soon enough that you can touch something on your eyeballs to make it, you know, give you a range as well. So scopes on muzzleloaders, I've been there with that with my son. Nice deer standing out there and pulls up the one power scope and he can't see a thing. And he's like, I don't know if I should shoot or not shoot. So I'm in favor. I think there probably should be a six power limit or something like that. I don't know the two power. I think if you go to two power, I think you might as well just take them off. I would be more in favor of maybe separating seasons and things like that to where, you know, I know that there used to be a late season, and I think that was maybe detrimental on the, from a biological standpoint is what I'd heard about, you know, the rut and so forth. But I definitely, a lot of muzzleloader guys have gone away from muzzleloading because of the season change. As you know, as a public at large guy, just listening to all the comments, I'm definitely in favor of long range hunting. Calibers I don't think matter. I'm not going to shoot an animal with a 50 cal. I'm not. I'm going to try to take the animal legally, ethically. So the bottom two, I definitely agree that large calibers, you know, there probably has to be a point to it, the .49. I'm like Randy here. I've got a lightweight 338 Lapua, so the weight wouldn't matter. It'd have to be a caliber restriction. Yardage, I think it'd be so hard for Jack to, you know, well, you shot that animal too far away. You know, how do you monitor that? I don't think you can. So
I know you can't. That's a tough one. That's up to every hunter to make that. What's my maximum distance?
And I practice a lot at long range, and so that's the one thing is I practice a lot. So there's lots of factors that go into it.
If you make a really cool shot one time, don't put it on YouTube. Just show it on home video at your house.
I've actually been on TV shooting long range, so it's too late.
I probably do not support the use of crossbows. In fact, if I had my way, I'd get rid of the compound bows too. Just have them make the willow like the Indians used to do.
Oh, you want the, all the atlatl, huh?
Yeah.
I think there was a discussion.
I'm just kind of from the old school that way. As far as range finders on bows, I suppose since we allow range finders, I wouldn't see a big deal with that. I do not support scopes on muzzle loaders. I think that's kind of it defeats the purpose of the muzzle loader hunt. I mean, it was that hunt was brought in to use primitive weapons, and now we keep building them up to modernize them, to me it's just an oxymoron to let them keep making them better. If they want the telescopic sights and whatnot, I'd say they should be hunting on the rifle hunt or the any weapon hunt. So I don't support any kind of glass on muzzle loaders myself. I don't have an issue with the calibers at all. I think that should be open. In fact, we allow rifle slugs come out of a shotgun and they're pretty big. So, and the smart guns, I think that's ridiculous. That takes the fair sport to chase away and on us. So I wouldn't be supportive of that.
Thank you.
Well, all in all, I've heard them all. Grew up, started with muzzleloaders, been hunting bows, shooting bows with my family. Several rifle hunts, hunted them all, but I personally feel that we don't have an issue here. The way the laws are, the way it is currently, I don't feel that there's an issue or a reason to revisit any of this. There's opportunity given to anybody that wants to do any method right now. And whether it's in September or whether it's in October during the any legal weapon. Go back to a few things that I've seen personally. You go in any of these sporting goods stores 3 days before the hunt, any hunt that is, and 90% of them are assembling some type of a weapon for somebody that's never shot it, that's going to go out there with a false sense of security that is going to increase their range or their ability to make an actual shot without practice. So you see that kind of stuff over and over to where it just builds, you know, being an archer myself, I mean, I'm confident with my bow. I shoot every month out of the year, leaves, the whole smash. But ethically, I know my limits. I know what, we're not supposed to look at ethics, but that same guy that was down there getting that bow put together was angry because he didn't get a rifle tag. There was a leftover archery tag that he could hunt down here in the valley, and if that means he's got to shoot 100 yards to get that one deer, so what? So from the fuzz I've gotten back from the from everybody else, the only thing I would say about the muzzleloaders, looking at age issues and things like that, two-power muzzleloader, scope on a muzzleloader, excuse me, would be the only thing I'd be in favor of. Everything else, I'd say leave well enough alone, other than the smart guns, I guess, by accident.
My turn?
Yeah, Brett.
I guess over the years I've harvested animals with all three weapons, so I'm a little bit familiar with them. I took the survey, and with the exception of the scopes on muzzleloaders, I was in the majority on all of the items. After listening to the discussion here, the two-power, I didn't realize the two-power was the same as your eye. I thought the one-power we had now was the same as your eye, so I guess I wouldn't really feel strongly about that, and I would think that the large calibers is something that we don't need to get in the middle of the way it sounds, and everything else I would support staying with the public.
For the official record, I'm not a hunter much anymore. I don't have a problem with crossbows. I think that would be fine, especially from what I've heard here today. The effectiveness is really not any greater. If that's the true statement, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with rangefinder on bows or scopes. Caliber is not an issue for me, and I don't have an opinion on smart guns.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
I ain't smart enough for smart guns. Anyway, me and Joe might be kind of in the same boat. A lot of our hunting is our depredation. Yeah. Depredation varmint hunting. So, and we both, you know, raise livestock in the agriculture business. Any technology that will make a weapon more deadly, in my book, will make it more humane, and there's less collateral damage. Technology helps me with what I do, prairie dogs and everything. So I'm on the other side of the spectrum for most of you people, I guess, being Joe. You know, if it's not just toting down like the smart guns, you know, that's just a little bit too far-fetched. You know, and like these two, you support two. I don't know how you don't support the other two. Basically the same type of things, the drill locks and the different things. So I'm a technology guy. If it'll make them more lethal, I'll support them. If they're just not totally out of whack like your smart gun.
Okay. Well, thank you. That helps us quite a bit. We'll come back in November with something. Or maybe nothing.
Now, can we use our drones?
No. Can't use a drone. No. That's already addressed. That's aircraft. So.
All right. Thank you, Kevin Coulson. Appreciate it very much. Trina, can you just give us an update on the Red Fleet?
Absolutely.
Real quick.
Sure. We are just plugging and checking, and we do anticipate having the road drone available by, I'm not going to lie, it's not necessarily going to be October 13th, but 14th, 15th, in there, that week of October 12th, simply because we were told that the road drone would be in the Texas facility the week of October 5th, 1 2-day turnaround time, and then shipped to us. So we have to be a little bit flexible, but we're still looking at that week of October 12th. And we've got about 28 folks set up to help out between pesticide applicators and our detoxification station down on Brush Creek. We've talked to the folks at the prison, and they're going to have some folks from the jail out there helping us move rope note around. That was kind of nice of them. It was one of Natalie's ideas. Let's get some prisoners out there and get them to work. And so they're going to help us out, so that's pretty cool. I'd love to be able to set a date, but I can't at this point, which would be a little bit vulnerable. But yeah, we're just plugging and chugging. We've got a list that we've got to work through, but we've got 4 weeks, 3.5 weeks to do it. And be A-okay. I know we'll be A-okay. We've got lots of stuff coming in between safety equipment and our potassium permanganate has arrived, and we got some more pumps coming in. We're testing, servicing the pumps that we already have and building aspirators, the stuff that makes the slurry to put out the rope now. Just tell you to check.
Are we still on track in November to do some planning?
Yes, so I guess we have to make a decision about when the hatchery wants to know, of course, when can we get these fish out, but of course we have to have it, the rope known has to be at a certain level. You know, it has to be at about like 10 parts per million or less, and you can't just go and take a sample and test it in the field. You just can't do that. So we've got some ways. We can put out some sentinel fish, and we can take a sample and send it in and get it back a couple days later. I don't have an exact date on when we can get fish in, but yes, it will be November. And for Kip's sake and Mike McCurdy's sake, over at the hatchery as soon as we can.
Okay, now my cow's going to be okay down
there? Yes, your cows are going to be
the chickens.
They'll be purple, though, remember?
Yeah, and but they're not going to get high. They'll just get high. That is it.
They'll be fine. So our potassium permanganate.
How about me?
You'll be able to find them in the dark.
We're going to be okay. Well, I'm just blowing a dam. We'll be okay.
Yes.
Everybody heard this.
So we.
You asked if you would be okay.
Well, I'm never okay.
We did a 30-minute travel time, and it stays within the Bureau of Reclamation's area, actually. So that 30-minute travel time is the expectation of when you'll have your rote known completely oxidized by the potassium permanganate. So no rote known downstream. It will be kind of brown by the time it hits your property. It'll look like there's just tannins in the water, and that's the potassium permanganate. But all that is potassium and manganese and oxygen.
Just don't look when you drink.
Don't drink.
It's not like the water in the gold mine.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen to the fish that's going to flow to the banks and things like that?
About 70% in one study I read, at least 70% fell to the bottom, 30% came up. Walleye will pop up first. The tiger muskie are really supposed to do too. Not in this instance, obviously, but walleye will probably be the first species to pop up because they're so sensitive, and like the black bass, the large ones, and small mouth will be. Probably a couple of hours. And so some will come up gasping for air. Eventually, what will happen is the fish that come up to the surface will stay on the surface and they'll get blown to a shoreline. So you often see fish just along the shoreline. But most of them just get recycled into the system. I put a dump card the other day, so we'll be taking, we have to take barrels anyway, the old barrels. Also taking some of the dead fish to the dead animal pit at the dump, just because State Park had concerns. You know, we're not going to close the park, so dead fish.
Does it kill those mussels?
We haven't had a positive detection on mussels since 2008, but no, you have to treat it 15 parts per million to kill mussels. So there are other chemicals that we use, but the Bureau of Reclamation uses them to try.
You haven't got a problem with them, I bet you.
It's now inconclusive. We haven't had a positive in so long that we downlisted it to what we consider inconclusive. So we don't consider it a problem anymore. You no longer have to wash all boats coming off.
If things eating the fish, does it have a buildup in the system at all?
No, at the concentrations that we'll be treating in with, I guess would be the right term, one part per million, it's all about concentration level. So it could have an impact to mammalian species or bird species if we were treating at really high concentrations, but the concentrations that we are treating at, no. And in fact, it's actually readily digested in mammalian and avian digestive tracts. So yeah, you'd have to be way higher than the EPA would let you treat at.
How is it killing the fish exactly?
So it inhibits cellular level, it inhibits oxygen transport from the gills to the rest of the body. So anything that's a gill breather gets hit pretty hard. So zooplankton get hit pretty hard.
crayfish don't tend to get hit really hard, and they can actually just leave the water, so it's not going to kill the crayfish, which is nice. We'll have a prey base there. Zooplankton will bloom. That, you know, they're more apt to have like a bigger bloom in the spring and in the summer, but we'll still have some zooplankton coming back. So after a couple of weeks.
How effective? I mean, as far as like total kill. 99.9, what do you feel like your percentage of?
There's not much other, I mean, there's sources of water coming in, just Brush Creek. So 100% kill is what I anticipate. It's the problems you can have on a rodent treatment is where you don't get 100% kill is you've got spring water coming in maybe that you're not aware of, so you don't account for that. Or you have high organic matter, like at the inlet of Brush Creek. We might have to treat a little bit higher than what I anticipated. There's a lot of just algae in that inlet. So that algae and organic matter just breaks down. It just takes up that rodent and just breaks it down very quickly. So we might have to treat a little bit higher. What you do is you just kind of keep an eye on the fish in that area. Springs, though, if you've got springs and seeps and standing water, like at Milford Sheep Creek, where the water would flow through these wet meadows, high organic matter, and it's starting to settle out. We had to really have some folks come in with backpack sprayers, really. In the sand, yeah, which is just kind of a mix of gelatin water and rotenone powder that stays, keeps it hot, slowly diffuses the rotenone out. So, but we shouldn't have that ever. Yeah.
Is that? Wasn't there a advisory, isn't that one of the bodies of water that's high in mercury for the fish? And where's the mercury coming that's getting in there? Out of the atmosphere?
Because it's not high in our naturally high in our soils, I would guess atmospheric deposition, but that's not my area of expertise. And I don't know that Division of Air Quality has done that tracking. I think they would be the people that would look at that, or Division of Air Quality. It's really hard to track.
And I would be careful on whether or not there could be something they didn't try to in the area that could be
regarding the state. Yeah. I don't know that anyone's looked at it, but certainly not my area.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Well, that's the end of our agenda items. I guess I'd entertain a motion to dismiss.
A motion to dismiss.
Thank you. Second.
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.